All righty, we're on the air, everybody's here. Okay. Anyone that walks in now is tardy. There you are. Oh, this isn't school, all right.
You're tough.
I am tough, well, I'll tell you. No slack. No, actually, my nickname at school is Gore the Gracious. I'm known as the soft touch around the school, so that's the way it is. Well, we are in Exodus chapter 20 this morning. This is our last session before our summer break. So if we don't get it said today, it ain't going to get said, at least for a summer or so. But we've been working our way through this. We've indicated this is really the centerpiece of the book of Exodus. Everything that's gone before has been leading us to this moment, and really the rest of Exodus is in some ways the aftermath and unpackaging of the significance of the things that happen here. So the Ten Commandments represent that great, wonderful moment when God entrusts His wisdom to humanity. And of course it was given, as we were saying last week, not to Israel for Israel's sake, but to Israel for the world's sake. That to them were entrusted the oracles of God, not as their private possession, but as that which would become a source of illumination, and indeed it has been throughout history. Last week we looked at the first three, so I left a pretty tall order for myself this week. Come right in, right up front. Great to see you. That's good. It's hard to be subtle in here, you know, you just kind of, you know, you can't really. That's right. So anyway, first commandment, of course, the prohibition against having any other god in God's presence. No other objects of worship are tolerated. That's for our good. It's not only the way it ought to be in terms of the reality of things, but it's the way it ought to be for purposes of our own integrity, our own well-being. It requires that we have one thing that we place our entire loyalty to, and everything else then takes its proper place. No man can serve two masters. We fragment when we try to do that. And the first commandment is the great psychological remedy to about 1,000 problems that we have, isn't it? To just put the right thing in the right place. The second commandment says we can't reduce this God we worship to something contained in materiality. That this metaphysical reality of God cannot be poured into the concrete and mortar of this world. Heaven and earth can't contain Him, much less the artifacts that we produce. And so we can't insult the divine majesty by trying to put that into some little creation of our own design. The third commandment is the commandment with respect to how we speak of this great being. This is the one whose awe should be reflected in the way that we refer to Him. And so we have a prohibition against using His name in a thoughtless way, a vain way, a mindless way. That there should always be gravity, in a sense, in the way that we refer to Him. And that brings us to the fourth commandment, which we should have covered last week, but didn't quite get to it. So we'll start there. This is verse 8, Exodus chapter 20. And we'll just take it one little nibble at a time here. So let's read this paragraph and then we'll work our way through it. This is the Word of God. Remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien who is in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. So there's our initial text. Let's ask God's blessing on our consideration of it. Father in heaven, we are deeply grateful to you for the rich and lavish mercy that you pour out upon us day by day, week by week. We thank you for opportunities that we have to sit and reflect on the riches of the truth that you've given us in your word. We grope in the darkness, however, without your Spirit. And so we invoke at this time, in the name of Christ, that Holy Spirit, which will open our eyes and dispose our hearts to not only hear and understand, but to believe and to embrace and to indeed live by these wonderful principles of life that you've given to us here. We give you thanks for all of that in the name of Christ. Amen. Well, there's room in the front row. Lots of room up here. Oh, these are the $5 seats up here, you know, and they're all empty, so. All right. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We've talked about the Sabbath before, of course, and I don't want to spend too much time revisiting things that we've discussed in the past, but of all of the Ten Commandments, I think you know this is the one that has been the subject of the greatest apparent revision in terms of how we see it from a New Testament point of view. If we look at all 10 of the commandments that are given to us in the Ten Commandments, all of them are repeated, re-emphasized, reinforced, verbatim in the New Testament, with the exception of this one. This is the one that we never hear simply restated and announced to the people of God as a rule for life. And so that has caused the church historically to consider at least the possibility that there was some kind of re-engineering of this particular commandment. Not that it goes away, but that it looks a little different when we get to the New Covenant era. There have been dissenters to that, as you know, and we have, you might say, in the history of the church, two extremes. We have kind of the mainstream of Christian understanding, which is the church in the main, down through history. And then on the one hand, we have a fairly, a minority, pretty sizable, I would say a sizable but small minority, who would say, we are supposed to observe this commandment on its terms. That this indeed continues to be obligatory for Christian people, and that we are in error, you and I, for being here on Sunday. We should have been here yesterday, that we are in fact disregarding what God has evidently made a rule for us. And we find that, of course, among Seventh-day Adventists. We find it among Seventh-day Baptists. There are those out there and a few others who have taken that particular rule. The Seventh-day Adventists originally taught, Ellen G. White taught, and her followers taught that it was the mark of the beast. It is the mark of the Antichrist to worship on Sunday. Now, you don't hear quite so much about that anymore, but it's still part of their official teaching. That's how seriously they take this command and how much of an error they view it that we are here on Sunday worshiping. On the other hand, you have another kind of minority at the other extreme that would say this whole Sabbath thing is fully abrogated. That in a sense in the New Testament we only have 9 commandments, and that the commandment with respect to the Sabbath has completely gone away, and Christians are utterly at liberty at this point to, you know, fully disregard it. The church has never been real comfortable with either of those extremes. We have, on the one hand, believed that there is some sense in which the Sabbath command has continuity, and yet we also think that that continuity, it looks a little different with the advent of the work of Christ and the New Testament era. We find evidence for that in the life of Christ himself. Jesus seems to go out of his way to pick a fight with the religious establishment on the Sabbath issue. It's amazing how much of the New Testament, the gospel accounts, deal with Sabbath controversies. How many of the controversies relate to Jesus doing something that seems to challenge the status quo with respect to how they understand the Sabbath. You are well aware of that. We saw that last year in the Gospel of Luke, and it's pretty evident throughout the Gospel accounts. Not that Jesus is just simply throwing out the Sabbath, but we already see that there's a little bit of a different emphasis. That Jesus, for example, instead of following the accepted rule of resting on the Sabbath, seems to be one who works on the Sabbath and calls us to holy labor on the Sabbath. No ordinary labor, not running down to the office and billing a couple of hours, you know, and after church on Sunday, nothing like that. But there is a sense in which it seems that Jesus is recreating the Sabbath as a day of holy labor rather than a day of holy rest. And a great deal of what we see in those Sabbath controversies seems to go in that direction. But Jesus never expressly says anything about the Saturday Sabbath being no longer applicable or anything like that. That never happens. Then we look at the rest of the New Testament, and we find that the reference to the Sabbath is fully absent. Nothing in Paul that would reinforce it. In other words, no instruction, here's how you should, you know, behave on the Sabbath day or something like that. Nothing like that in Peter. Nothing in all the rest of the New Testament. It simply drops off the radar screen. Now that is an argument from silence. That doesn't prove anything either way, but it is interesting that while the other commandments are restated with some vigor, this one just kind of disappears from the interest of the New Testament. And indeed, if anything, what we find in the New Testament is a little bit of a negative attitude toward it. Paul in Romans 14 warns against people who become overly concerned with observing certain days, times, seasons, and so on. Colossians chapter 2, Paul expressly warns against a rigorous Sabbath-keeping mentality. Something like that in Galatians. And so we find Sabbath at least seems to be getting a little bit of a different tilt. The book of Hebrews seems to take a different view of the Sabbath. It says quite a bit about it, but it obviously is not quite the same thing as the Old Testament view. And so that has led Christians out into this kind of middle place of understanding there seems to be something that's there, but it doesn't look quite like the Old Testament rule. And for that reason, we find in the history of the church a fair amount of latitude. And among various Christian communities down through history, some you'll find tend toward a more rigorous kind of concern about observing a holy day, usually Sunday. Some are a little bit more relaxed, and all points in between. And it does seem, it seems to me that there is that kind of freedom that's given to the church with respect to how it is going to work out in history. I'm not dogmatic on it. I'm just saying from a point of view of history, it does seem we have that kind of fluidity about the question of the Sabbath. All right, having said all that, what I'd like to do, however, is come back to this particular paragraph and look at it in a little bit of detail in its historical setting. Even though we are at least taking the view that we're not bound to it in the way that we may be bound to the others, I think it's still instructive to hear something of what it says. So let's go back to the text. Remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy. Keep it set apart. It's part of the holiness code of the Old Testament. God's people are commanded to be holy, for God is holy. And the holiness idea with respect to the people of God was the sense in which they would be different. They would be distinguished from the other nations of the world, precisely because they were the priestly nation. And priest types are supposed to live by a somewhat higher standard. They're supposed to distinguish themselves by virtue of the code that they live by, and that seems to be obligatory with respect to the people of Israel. So their kosher laws, their regulations about clean and unclean, the variety of regulations that govern the life of the average Israelite didn't apply to the Hittites, didn't apply to the Egyptians. Even if they worshiped the one true God, they weren't expected to keep kosher. It seems that maybe this reference to the Sabbath has something of that going on, although that would be debated, and I'm certainly not taking a position on it. But it seems to be at least part of the holiness code of the people of God. Then this instruction, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. It's often missed that this command has two imperatives in it, doesn't it? A command to rest and a command to work. Always reminds me, when I tell this joke at school, nobody gets it. In this class, I know you'll all get it. It always reminds me of Maynard G. Krebs. Remember that? Work! My kids look at me, Maynard who? What's the matter with you kids? Don't you have any American culture in your bloodstream? Don't you have a Maynard G. Krebs? Come on. They have heard of Gilligan's Island. It was the same guy, of course, but quite a different role he played. But anyway, 6 days you shall work. The Old Testament rule with respect to the people of God was that they should work. That's a command as much as is the command to rest, In other words, there is a place in the life of God's people for work, for the ordinary work of self, sustaining labor and so on. And while that may seem a little obvious and not too important, when you take this rule and look at it in light of its context in the ancient world, certainly in 1500 BC, which would be in round numbers when this was announced, and even much later, this is really virtually unique, that work is given such dignity. You look at Aristotle, who's regarded as one of the great enlightened spirits, of course, of the ancient world. He's writing in the 400s, so it's a good 1,000 years after this, and even then, the ancient world still regards work as degrading. The only people who should work are the lower classes, the slaves, or those who are unworthy of this kind of elevated caste, virtually. Work isn't for the special people, the right people, the superior people. Work is for the people who are, in a sense, inferior, you know. And you look at that, you see that in Egypt, you see that in virtually every ancient civilization except one. And among the ancient Israelites, work was not only taken out of the status of being degrading, it was actually placed in the status of being an elevating thing, something that gives dignity, something that is contributes to the human sense of worth. The book of Proverbs, of course, is replete with this idea, but you find it elsewhere as well, that work is something that actually dignifies the human spirit. And that's a novelty in the ancient world. I think that in itself almost suggests to us this must have been of divine origins, because who would have dreamed it up, you see, that we should work and that work is good for us? And if you survey Western philosophy, really there's not a lot of attention to work until one particular philosopher, a very influential philosopher of Western thought, finally takes work and makes it the centerpiece of his philosophy. Builds everything around the notion of labor. And that is Karl Marx. Now, I'm not a Marxist. I think you probably suspect that. And I'm not here to give any great praise to Marx, but you need to give credit where credit is due. And at least at this point, Karl Marx, I think, made a great contribution. Now, I don't think he gave sufficient credit to that he should have. He was Jewish, and he grew up in a Jewish home. He repudiated all of that, of course, became a flaming atheist, which is another underpinning of his philosophy. But I do think that his diatribe against the industrial revolutionary 19th century with its sweatshops, its factories, its black smoke, its child labor, its, you know, really the grotesque side of that transformation of Western civilization, I think his diatribe against that was driven by his familiarity with the Old Testament. He grew up knowing it. He knew his Bible, especially the Old Testament. And he sounds a lot like Amos, who also criticizes the opportunistic kinds of forces that were affecting life at the time that Amos was alive. Mark sounds a little bit like an Old Testament prophet. He doesn't give good answers, in my opinion, to the problem, but I think his analysis of the problem is pretty close to the mark, and probably at least at that point he's worthy of a little bit of recognition, even on the part of us who may not have some great affection for him otherwise. But here we find way before Marx, way before he wrote his great philosophy, the Old Testament has already discovered how important it is. And of course, the importance of labor, as this text itself implies, goes back to creation. We were created to labor. We are a laboring species. That was part of the original created situation before the fall. You know, I've heard people say, no one in this room, because you are much too enlightened for this, but I've heard people say, oh, labor came in as God's punishment. No, no, no. We were created to labor. We were given a garden and told to till it, to, you know, care for it, to expand it. We were given the dominion mandate, and all of that took place before the fall ever entered. The quality of labor changed. Sweat of the brow, thorns, and all of that changed. But that we should labor and that labor would be central to our understanding of who we are was there, you know, before sin ever entered the picture. So 6 days you will labor and do your work. But, verse 10, the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, meaning any regular work. There's obviously allowance in the Old Testament for all kinds of work on the Sabbath, necessary labor, the labor of the priests and so on, but none of your regular workaday work, as it were. You shall not do any work. You, your son or your daughter, so it extends, the implication here to you would be the head of the house. In that patriarchal world, it would be the husband, the father. Then it extends to the family. Then it extends unexpectedly further than that, your male or female slave. Slavery was universal, as you know, in the ancient world. But here, a very non-universal rule is brought into focus. Even the slaves are to have a day off. This is the first labor law. It's in the Bible. See, Marx didn't come up with that. And so even the slaves, this was, you would not find anything like this, not even remotely like this, in Egyptian, Assyrian, Mesopotamian, Greek culture, not there. But now even the slaves, even those people who are regarded as property, are to be given the day off. That's a very dignifying component, isn't it? It's an implicit sort of recognition that these people are also human, unlike the surrounding nations, which viewed them essentially as chattel. No, they are to be given the same kind of treatment. Your male or female slaves, your livestock. So here's PETA should be happy with it. I've never heard anyone from PETA give credit where credit is due on this one. The first animal rights legislation, if you will. I hate that expression, but I guess that says something about me. But anyway, this whole notion of caring for livestock, beasts, are of a concern to ancient Israel. A righteous man has regard for the life of his beast, Solomon tells us, you know. And there is otherwise. If you just watch the story of how animals are treated in the Old Testament, you'll see a little bit of that. I mean, it's not, I don't want to overstate the point, but it's at least there at a somewhat subtle level. But here, this day off is to be extended even to these animals that are part of our world. And then finally, you're the alien resident within your towns. I mentioned this before, and I will say again, I don't intend any political comment whatsoever in terms of contemporary debates about borders and immigration and all of that. I'm simply saying as a matter of historical fact, and I'm not saying this becomes a paradigm for what, you know, American policy should be today. I'm not referring to that at all. I'm just saying as a matter of historical fact, Israel had an open borders policy. You could move to Israel and you could live there. There was no border guard, nothing like that. It was permissible and people did it, and we see plenty of evidence of it. The caveat to that is this. You could move to Israel and live there, but you could not create a subculture in Israel by which you imported the culture of your previous living situation. We've all heard of, you know, Little Italy, right? That idea. Chinatown. I wish we had a Chinatown in Spokane. I love it, you know? But we understand what that means. It means you can kind of go to that place, a sort of, in a polite sense of the word, ghetto, and feel like you've almost gone back to the mother country. Israel was never permitted to have a little Babylon, you know, a little Egypt, a little enclave by which the practices, the beliefs, the value system, the worship, etc., of the prior community was allowed to infiltrate itself. So you could move to Israel, no questions asked. Move right in, settle down, but you were expected to conform to the culture, the worship, the standards, the values, the ethics of Israel. So you're going to observe the Sabbath. You're not going to have household gods. Now, obviously, this rule wasn't always enforced very consistently, but that was the rule. Open borders, but not open culture, you see. Not open values. And so this is only one of many, many evidences of that principle that runs through the Old Testament. So the resident alien who lives in your town is also going to abide by this rule. Then the reference back to creation. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. It's been noted by many commentators that the entire Ten Commandments is rooted in creation. And I'm going to try to highlight that as we go here. This one certainly expressly is tied to creation. There is an idea, I think you could say, that the Ten Commandments is intended, as we live by its guidance, to recreate for us a little taste of Eden. That as we live by this rule, we experience in some modest degree a little feel for Eden. The very fact that there's rest is supposed to remind us, in a sense, of God's rest, and that we should have a rejuvenation, as it were, that's connected to this. And so the Lord creates, the Lord rests, and then we have creation. We labor. Labor produces. Labor produces wealth. The Bible said that before Adam Smith said that, that there is a productivity to labor that creates wealth. God created for 6 days, and what do we have as a result? Wealth. We labor, and it's productive of wealth, and then we rest, you see. And there's a kind of dignity about that rhythm that refers back to our being created in the image of God, and that we are reproducing, in a sense, in our own lives, something of God's own great work. What's interesting, and I'll just make this as a footnote now, this reference to the Sabbath in the creation account is very important. Chapter 2 begins with it, and then the Sabbath is never mentioned again in all the book of Genesis. We never hear of it in the life of Abraham. We never hear of Isaac and Jacob or the patriarchs. It's fully absent. We don't know what they did. Maybe they had some idea of that, but it's not recorded. And the fact that it's not recorded is what's important. It makes the argument, at least some commentators would say, it continues to make the argument that the use of the Sabbath was intended especially as a sign of the covenant through Moses. Not through Abraham. Abraham was given circumcision, he was not given Sabbath, in other words. But with Moses, we have now the incorporation of the Sabbath. And the argument would be that just as it came with Moses, so it is at least revised substantially with Christ, who brings us the new covenant, you see, that displaces the covenant with Moses, but does not displace the covenant with Abraham. Christ is the seed of Abraham. He is the realization of all that was promised to Abraham. But much of what's given to us in Moses, the sacrificial system and so on, are set aside with Christ. And that would be at least one way, one argument that's offered. I'm not saying it's definitive, dispositive, but nevertheless, it's interesting. All right, so that's number 4. Now we come to what's called the second table. The second table is the last 6 commandments. It begins with this, which is usually regarded as a transitional commandment. Honor your father and your mother so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. It's viewed as transitional because there's a sense when we move from the vertical obligations to the horizontal obligations, this is the one that kind of marks the transition. As I honor father and mother, I am honoring those who have authority by virtue of the fact that God has given them his authority. When a child honors his parents, there's a sense in which through them he's honoring God, that God has entrusted to parents something of God's own dignity, God's own glory. And a child sees that, first of all, in the parent, and learns through them to honor the parent that lies behind all of us. The parents also stand, in a sense, for the first authority the child ever deals with. And so, by extension, we could say this commandment is not only referring to parents, but referring to all the other authorities that God has given to us, governmental authority, you know, whatever authorities may be out there that we eventually learn to respect. A child that learns to respect his or her parent will have a much easier time respecting the police officer. You know that. That's just a, you know, it's a given. If a child learns to be disrespectful to a parent, he will be disrespectful to the other authorities. And so this is kind of the first opportunity to learn to respect the authorities in this world, understanding that those came by God's gift. Paul says that in Romans 13, the authorities that exist are from God. And as I honor those authorities, I'm honoring God. That's kind of a given. I think you all know that through the scriptures. And here it is. The authorities in this world are called by Calvin common grace. Calvin's idea was that we, even if we are not Christian believers, nevertheless live in the benefit of grace that God has given. That there are gracious provisions that God has made for the good of humanity. People may not properly worship the God who gave those gifts, but they still live in the benefit of them. God sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. There's that notion of a kind of common blessing that God gives, and one of those expressions of common grace, Calvin calls these governmental authorities. I think it's obvious enough why. If all those authorities disappear, we're plunged into what technically is referred to the absence of authority, no authority. And the common word we use for that is anarchy, anarche, no. You see, arche is rule, ruler, king, and so on. No rule. And most people who've been anywhere near something like that think it's the most dreadful circumstance you could imagine. As a rule, people will take iron-fisted totalitarianism any day over anarchy, where I live in constant fear of my neighbor intruding and exploiting and invading, where the biggest stick always wins the fight. We don't like that. That's not a fun way to live, you know. And most of us prefer an ordered, structured stability to human society, where I have a certain sense that as I get on the freeway and drive down, I'm not going to have people coming at me out the wrong side of the road. There's going to be a little bit of predictability about life. And at least in some substantial measure, the reason that happens is because God has ordained these authorities to protect human order. And that's why, as we do that, our days will be long. Anarchy always, translates into usually short lives. You don't live very long where there is no order. It's hard to get life insurance in an anarchic society. The risks are too high. Hard to do actuarial tables, you know, in a situation like that. But as I honor father and mother, and beyond them honor, of course, the institutions of authority that God has given, it creates that longevity, which is only possible under those circumstances. The Bible otherwise, though, has a lot of interest in father and mother. You all know I lost both my father and my mother this last year. And, you know, as much as you think about it, I'm 62. It's not like I lost them in some totally unexpected way as a young person. It's been traumatic. Many of you have been through this experience, and it doesn't matter when it happens in your life. There's an unexpected trauma to it that I have to say I'm still feeling. It is true, isn't it, that the centrality of those people in our lives is almost impossible to calculate. Now, some parents are better than others. We know that. My parents were wonderful. I'm grateful for the rich gift that God gave me of both my beloved mom and dad. Not everybody has such wonderful experiences with parents. But that there is, in spite of the character of the parent, nevertheless a requirement to honor the office and to somehow see in that, sometimes by contrast, you know, by negative example, to see in that something of the good that God has given to us, I think is essential to keeping this. That, again, was not necessarily true of every culture in the ancient world. Some had it better than others. Some would practice the dreadful kind of ethic of saying, well, once a person got to a certain age, you would just sort of leave them out under a tree somewhere and, as the expression is used, expose them. You know, the first expression of euthanasia in the ancient world. They've outlived their usefulness. There are places in the world where that still is practiced to this day. Happily, not many places. End of life, beginning of life. That's how you measure a culture. That's how you measure the sophistication of a culture. Not every culture in the ancient world was quite as ruthless as that. Some, to their credit, had great respect for elders. And so this is not, I cannot say to you that this was a uniquely Jewish rule, but it was certainly the case that many did not have that kind of reverence, both for end of life and the help that is needed there, or beginning of life. Infanticide was quite common in the ancient world. Abortion was quite common in the ancient world. In my opinion, you can gauge the sophistication of a culture by looking at those two ends of the spectrum, the weak, the helpless, those who need more than they can give, and what does the culture do with them, you know? And so in a sense, this command stands, in a sense, for that great recognition of the value of life, regardless of whether the life is doing anything much for me at the moment. So we have this great rule, and I'll leave it at that. Let's go to the next one. You shall not... How am I doing here? I should watch this. Oh, not well. Okay. You know, you have no idea. When I go through this lesson at home, it just comes out just right. Then I get in front of you, and I get juiced up. I don't know what happens. I kind of... Oh. All right, we got to speed up a little bit. You shall not murder. All right, this is an interpretation, not a translation. I'm using the NRSV, as some of you are. Some of you have different renderings. The Hebrew word here simply means kill. It's a much broader word. It doesn't mean illegitimate killing. It just means killing. It's a word that would apply with equal legitimacy to a human being or to a grasshopper. Thou shalt not kill. I'm not making a case. Don't get nervous. I'm not going where you may think I'm going right now. You don't find this kind of rabid, you know, well, now I won't finish that because I use that adjective that anything I say there is inappropriate. But anyway, you don't find, I'll put it this way, radical pacifism, let's put it that way, in the Old Testament. You certainly find in the casuistry of the Old Testament plenty of allowance for capital punishment, plenty of allowance for the need for war and so on. So that, we just have to take that at face value. But what I'm saying right here is simply this. The word itself stands in a deep sense for the value of life. It is a great affirmation of the worth of life. That also takes us back to the Garden of Eden. Every one of these takes us back to Eden. Life comes in the Edenic situation by the breath of God, you see. Life is not simply a coincidence, a chemical reaction. One of the great ironies, I think, of the 20th century is that Francis Crick, who's the character, you know, Thomas and Crick were the two guys that figured out the double helix of DNA and all of that. Crick was the one who said he went into this area of biology because he wanted to, quote, exorcise the demon of vitalism from biology. He was an atheist to his dying day, and yet probably gave more horsepower to the intelligent design movement than any other single person, because the deeper he dug into the human cell, the more complexity he found. And it becomes so complex, it is mind-boggling. You see, what's going on there? The information age was happening deep inside the human, you know, cell before it was ever dreamed up by somebody at IBM. And this has been one of the greatest reversals of the attempt to exorcise the demon of vitalism. It's caused many people to think there is no other way we can account for this remarkable phenomenon, that there's some kind of divine explanation for it. It smacks of heaven that we have life. And then we look at a world around us that's just burgeoning with life. We see green trees, you know, we see animal life, we see a world that just seems to be irrepressibly alive around us. And while we may sometimes take that for granted, just a casual thought about it, especially when we look at something as barren as the moon or Mars, or, you know, to our knowledge, any planets out there, as desperately as they're trying to find any little hope of some minuscule evidence of life, it so far hasn't shown up. I'm not sure it ever will, you know. But here's this planet Earth, just overflowing with life. What is that? That's God. Every time we see a green tree, we should say there's a little bit of God in that. You know, I'm not a pantheist, you understand that? But there is this sense in which we see the evidence of God in every breath we take. You know the name Albert Schweitzer. He was a very highly respected New Testament scholar who was so seized in conscience with the plight of the medical condition of folks in Africa that he, after having made quite a name for himself in, as a young man, as a New Testament scholar, he was fairly liberal. I don't really, you know, agree with a whole lot of what he was arguing for, but he was a great scholar nevertheless, went back to medical school and went off, and of course for 40 years, in a fairly obscure outpost in Africa, served as a medical missionary. And though he was serving in relative obscurity, he became a world-famous name. I don't think he intended that. Eventually won a Nobel Prize for that, those years of selfless service, which he loved and devoted himself to, serving those who could either not repay him or certainly couldn't repay him adequately for his expertise throughout the years. When he was interviewed, as he often was, as to why he was there, what this was about, he reduced his ethic to one little phrase, three words. He published on this. It became more or less the motto of his life. And it was, anybody happen to know? Three little words. Anybody know? Reverence for life. That was it. And he was great. He was deeply committed to the idea I'm suggesting to you here, that there is a sense in which we should look with wonder at life. And thus killing in any form should always give us pause. Now, the Old Testament knows there are times when there is a time to kill, as Solomon says, you know. There is just war. There is capital offense. Even capital offense in the Old Testament is sanctioned, however, based on the value of life. You look at Genesis 9:6, where capital punishment is instituted under the Noahic covenant, as it's called. And that verse says, if man sheds a man's blood, then by man his blood will be shed. There's the institution of capital punishment. Then the rationale is given in these words, because in the image of God he was created. You see. And the reference is back to our dignity as created beings in the image of God. So that if I assault you, one who bears God's image, then I am doing something just right next to assaulting God. You know, if the President of the United States is attacked, we don't view that as an attack on one man. We view it as an attack on a whole nation, don't we? He stands for that which whose image he carries. And in a sense, when somebody attacks a human being, they're attacking God, the image bearer. And that's such a colossal crime that it warrants the forfeiture of the life of the person who did the attacking. That's the biblical kind of justification for it. So even capital punishment is related in some way to the value, the dignity, the worth of human life, you know. So anyway, the rule there that we should be life givers. I think the practical application of that for us as Christian people is that every day we should pray as part of our mantra at the beginning of the day, Father, help me as I go through this day to give life to the people I meet. You know that? You know there's some people you meet, they're like a black hole. They just suck the life out of you. You ever notice that? Or is it, there are some people you meet, and for all the world, you walk away 5 minutes later, you're more alive. They gave you life. You know. We have that ability to minister grace. Paul says, don't let destructive communication proceed out of your mouth, but only such as good for edifying, that you may give grace to the person who heard you. We are sacramental in some way just by the words we speak. We can be a means of grace. Did you know that? You can be a means of grace to every person you meet and give them life. You can leave them more alive than the way you found them. That's the way we as Christians can take this command and kind of make it part of our life. All right, next one, you shall not commit adultery. Not much to say on that one. What is this? This takes us back to Eden, doesn't it? There's one human institution that was ordained for human good before the fall, as we hear at every wedding, in the time of man's innocency. You know that most human institutions are remedial. They're fixing something that was broken. Human government, fixing something that was broken. James Madison said in Federalist 10, if men were angels, we'd have no need of government. Famous line. It's true. We're not angels. Something's wrong. Even the church is remedial. Something's broken, and we need that great ministry of grace and redemption. The one institution that was given to humankind before we were broken was the institution of marriage. God didn't look at the universe and say, oh, it's bad, I need to fix it, therefore give marriage. He looked at the universe and said, it is good, now I'm going to make it better. I'm going to make it so it's very good. And so he gives us this first human community, first human society. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The Hebraism there, whatever I'm trying to say, is they will become one organism. The two become one. We're living, as you know, at a time when the institution of marriage is embattled, to say the least, even in our Presbyterian church, embattled. I think the great case against alternative approaches to marriage and to the sexual aspect of our life, the best case to be made biblically is not so much prohibitive, though that is certainly there. There are the thou shalt nots in the Bible with respect to a variety of sexual practices that are not considered to be right or good or obedient to God. But the best case, the most formidable case, is the affirmative case for marriage. That biblically that stands at the core and heart of what is the beginning of health for human beings. Even if you're not married, it still is something that you live in the benefits of day in and day out. It's been said and used to be taught constantly, I don't hear it so much anymore in standard education, that the family is the building block of society. You've ever heard that? You know, isn't it true? And when you begin to see a society that attacks the family, you know that the trajectory for that society cannot be good, that there is a kind of unraveling that will necessarily occur. It's been discovered countless times in history by those people who've tried to find a different model. Plato came up with the idea in his Republic, as enlightened as he is. Let's just have common, you know, children. Everybody cares for everybody. He's the first guy who said it takes a village. Let's just have everybody care for everybody's kids. It's in his Republic, you know. How well did that work? Not well. Not well. Aristotle was the first guy to criticize his master for that absurdity. Who's going to care for the kids if not their parents? Who else wants the kids except their parents? You know. Aristotle figured that one out. We need the family. And this command, though stated negatively, is really standing for the great affirmative of that beginning of human society that becomes the substructure and the underpinnings of all human society. All right. Oh, we're doing great. I got 30 seconds. Let's go. You shall not steal. This goes back to the creation. Because, as we were saying earlier, we were put in the garden to labor, and just as God's labor would produce wealth, so our labor produces wealth. That's the connection. Biblically, it's a principle restated countless times. Diligent hands make rich. It's the idea that labor produces wealth. At the time Adam Smith wrote, there was a prevailing economic theory called mercantilism. It proceeded on the assumption that there's a fixed amount of wealth in the world, and the task of nations was to try to get as much of the slice of the pie as they could. Hence, you had exploitive, you know, conquistatorial campaigns to go and get somebody else's gold and so on. It was like there was only a certain amount, and whoever had the most of it wins. Adam Smith made the, and he credited the Bible for this wisdom, there's not a fixed amount of wealth in the world. The amount of wealth varies depending on the productive labor that's being performed. Where does the wealth of nations come from? It comes from productive labor. That's how you get rich, by being productive in your labor. God was productive in his labor, and he put human beings in the garden to till it, to care for it, to take dominion over it, to expand its borders, and to day by day increase the net wealth, as it were, in the world by modeling what God himself had done. Now, when I invade your legitimate wealth and take it, then I have not simply done something that is illegal, I have done something that is anti-holy. I violated a sacred trust, you see. And many of you have felt this experience. I remember some years back when I was single, many, many years ago, I was living in a downstairs apartment in a little rented, you know, kind of downstairs thing. And the people I was living with were burglarized one day. I remember this. It was years ago, but it stayed with me to this day because it was such an unexpected emotion. So my little apartment got burglarized. And I knew it when I got home. The guy told me somebody broke in today, and, you know. And so I was afraid that maybe I'd lost my favorite widget, you know. I was kind of concerned about that. You know, what did they find? They got away with my 45 cents that I'd saved up. But you know, the thing that I was not expecting, and I know some of you have had a similar experience, when I walked in to that room and saw my stuff strewn across the floor and realized there had been some stranger rifling through my stuff, I felt raped. You ever had that? I felt violated. I didn't expect that emotion. You know, I thought I might be angry, but that feeling of having been personally violated by somebody going through my stuff, that feel, I thank God I haven't had that experience very often in my life, but that sticks with me, and I know some of you know what I'm talking about. I think there's something theological in that, that God has created us such that as we labor and do what God himself did and we acquire legitimately that which he entrusts to us as a natural consequence of our labor, there is a kind of sacred connection there. It doesn't justify greed. I'm supposed to use this that I produce charitably. I'm supposed to freely give it. I'm not supposed to be, you know, overly acquisitive with it. But I can't even give. I cannot even give an offering. I cannot give a gift unless there is a notion of property. Unless there's a notion of proper ownership, there's nothing I have to give away. This was another thing. This is where Marx missed it, you know. He thought, well, we can get rid of private property and solve the world's problems. And every time it's been attempted, as you know, it's been a colossal failure. Because you destroy the human spirit when my labor doesn't somehow translate into something, a trust, then the whole incentive for labor is undercut. Stalin discovered it, Lenin discovered it, you know, the whole Soviet Empire discovered it as people lived in radical poverty because the human spirit was being destroyed. It's been discovered many other times. I don't need to tell you the story of that. But all right, last two. Sorry, I'm keeping you a couple of minutes. But hey, I'm not going to have you all summer. You shall not bear false witness. This goes back to creation and speech. God gave humanity the capacity and the responsibility to speak truth, to engage in taxonomy, to put words to things that would correspond to the reality of things. That's what words are supposed to do. And when I start using words so that the words correspond to that which is not real, that which is fictitious, or that which is false, then I violated the sacred trust of my words. You know. And so we should, as Paul says it so wonderfully in the New Testament, speak the truth in love. If we just speak the truth, it could be highly destructive. You know, if you just speak the truth every time it occurs to you. Well, that was the experiment I remember from college. Let's just be honest. Oh, some of the damage that was done in the name of honesty, I hate to think about. Now, speak the truth, but speak the truth in love. Jesus was the perfect example. If it's just love and no truth, sweet little lies, that's no better, you know. But when we speak the truth, Jesus did that. You never had a conversation with the man, but what you heard, truth, God's truth. But it was always from a heart that was perfectly concerned about your well-being. Even when he said to the Pharisees, "You bunch of snakes," you know, that was true. It was a correct metaphor. But even then, he was saying it redemptively. Even then, there was the opportunity to change and repent. And finally, thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, his male or female slave, ox, donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. To set my affections on that which is not mine and could not legitimately be mine. This is not a prohibition against going to the store and buying a toy that you want. That's okay, it's fine, you know, because it can be yours legitimately, and as long as you're not being irresponsible otherwise with your wealth, it's fine. But when I set my affections on another man's wife or on something that I cannot legitimately own and have, then Paul calls that idolatry. And so it's interesting, isn't it, that the Ten Commandments begins with idolatry and ends with idolatry. And the Ten Commandments ends with the root of the violation of every other command. When I steal from my neighbor, when I lust for that which is my neighbor's, when I lie to my neighbor, when I kill my neighbor, when I don't honor my father and mother, all of the things that are prohibited here begin with this illegitimate fixation on that which is not rightfully, nor could ever be rightfully mine. Covetousness in the final analysis is my overt expression of discontent with what God has given me. Paul says, I've learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. And we all have good reason to be content. And there is a wonderful sweet-spiritedness about a content person. But when I look across the fence and say, that guy has what I wish I had, then I say to God, you didn't do much good for me. This world you created for me is not all that great. I don't like this so much. You really gave me a raw deal, God, because I want that, you see. And that is the deepest kind of hostility and ungratefulness, to set my heart on something that God has been pleased not to give me because he knew it wouldn't be good for me, and I say, I got to have it. That's idolatry. So the Ten Commandments starts and ends with that great principle. Okay, I'm done.